everybody. I'm really excited to participate in this panel. I helped with putting it together, and I'm excited to hear from the other panelists and that Jose is able to be a pitch hitter with us, and hopefully we'll have a good conversation. I'm going to talk to you today about some of my dissertation work. This is the first part of my dissertation, and I don't have any relationships to disclose. So today I'm going to talk to you about agricultural exceptionalism. What do I mean by that? So for the past century, workers in agriculture have been excluded from many of the labor protections that we have. In U.S. history, farm workers have been left out of labor standards that we as a society have really deemed basic and necessary for all other workers. So what I'm going to do is give you a brief history of agricultural exceptionalism, and I'll talk to you about some of my own findings in this area. So to begin, let's go back to the 1930s. Prior to the 30s, the U.S. didn't have national social programs. Then we had this devastation of the Great Depression, and FDR passes a sweeping package of social reforms that we refer to as the New Deal. Among new protections for workers are collective bargaining rights, minimum wage provisions, maximum hours, we got Social Security, we got unemployment insurance, we got a massive public jobs creation program. The New Deal clearly redefined standards for American workers. But not for everybody. During the passage of the New Deal, Southern Democrats held some very important seats in Congress, and without their support, these social reforms would not have made it through. They did support these social reforms, but their support was conditional. These Southern members were beholden to very powerful agricultural interests in the South, and those interests were invested in the old way of doing things. And the old way of doing things was a plantation economy that really relied on the subjugation of black sharecroppers. This, of course, had its roots in slavery. They were interested in maintaining that status quo. So to protect that status quo, these Southern Democrats threatened to withdraw their support of the New Deal in its entirety, ruin the whole, all of FDR's agenda, unless an exception to these provisions were carved out for agricultural workers. Some Southern members gave explicit testimony during the passage of these laws that said they were very concerned that without an exception for agriculture, black and white laborers in the South would be paid the same thing, and they did not want that. So these Southern members were successful, and they gained exclusions for farm workers from rights to unionize, to unemployment insurance, workers' comp, minimum wage, overtime, and today many of these exclusions still stand. My work focuses on minimum wage and overtime, and these were established specifically by the Fair Labor Standards Act. Sorry if my voice is wavering, I'm coming down with something. So in the 60s, there was an amendment to the Act that did extend minimum wage protections to large farms, but still small farms and some other categories of farm workers are excluded from rights to minimum wage. All farm workers in federal law are exempt from overtime protection. Now, states can go above the federal protections, and that's what we're looking at here in this map. Employers in those states with stronger protections have to comply with higher of the two standards. You can see, for instance, here that many states have minimum wage laws above the federal wage. And while we know about agricultural exceptionalism at the federal level, there's been very little research into what states have done to improve protections for farm workers. Do they also exempt farm workers in their laws? We don't know. So that's what my research focuses on. And to answer these questions, I did a comprehensive 50-state legal and regulatory mapping of minimum wage and overtime. And even though there are no federal standards for rest and meal breaks, I added that to my search as well to see when states have rest and meal break provisions, do they exclude farm workers? Basically, what that means is I read all 50 states' labor laws and regulations in the areas of minimum wage, overtime, rest, and meal breaks, and I identified where they provide farm workers with less protection than other workers. So I'm going to give you some of the most basic results today. If you have specific questions about states, it's a lot. Feel free to see me after or ask questions. So in the area of minimum wage, 45 states have their own standard. That's what we were looking at the previous map. That means that five states just don't have anything on the books. They defer to the federal standard. And of the states that have their own standard, 76%, so over three quarters of them, have some exception for farm workers. That means that only less than one quarter of states provide standards for farm workers that equal those that protect other workers. States that don't exempt farm workers are listed here, and I won't take up your time by speaking them out loud, but I just wanted to give you an idea. So according to the National Agricultural Workers Survey, 50% of laborers in farm jobs work over 40 hours a week. And a quarter of farm workers work more than 50 hours a week, which means that many, many farm workers would qualify for overtime pay if they were working in any other kind of field. 32 states have their own overtime standard, and every single one of those exempts farm workers to some degree. California and Maryland do provide farm workers with overtime protection, but they're standards that are weaker than those for the rest of laborers in that state. So for instance, in California, most workers get overtime if they work over 8 hours in a day or over 40 hours in a week. Farm workers get overtime if they work over 10 hours in a day or 60 hours in a week. So minimum wage standards and overtime standards in the states have high exceptions for farm workers, and we can imagine why this must be. First of all, there's a federal example that the states might follow, but more importantly, we can imagine that the ag industry would have a high economic incentive to fight for exceptions to these laws, like they did way back when. Overtime standards, for instance, obviously equate to more pay for more work. 21 states have meal period standards, and only four of those states have exceptions for farm workers. Now, under federal law, even though there's no meal period standard, when states give meal period standards, they're not required to be paid. So if we take an economic and interest group lens here, we can imagine why fighting for exceptions to meal period standards for farm workers wouldn't really be a high priority. Meal periods do not economically impact growers the same way minimum wage and overtime do. And moreover, for workers that are paid by the piece, so by pound or by bucket, rather than by the hour, they have an incentive to skip breaks. Meal and rest breaks equate to, for them, less pieces picked and therefore less pay. So a lot of workers skip breaks, even if they're entitled to them. Only 11 states have rest period standards for workers, and only three of those states have exceptions for farm workers. Unlike meal periods, when an employer offers between 5 and 20 minutes, federal law does require employers to pay for that time. So if rest periods are paid time, why might there be so few exceptions for farm workers? Well, maybe because, as I said, many farm workers are paid by the piece, not hourly. Again, this form of payment incentivizes workers to skip breaks. And breaks that are taken for piece rate workers are generally unpaid. However, this year in July in Washington State, which is one of the states that does have rest period standards, their state Supreme Court ruled that employers in agriculture do need to pay piece rate workers for breaks at least the rate that they make when they're working. So that actually might open up rulings in similar states with rest period standards, and I'm excited to see what happens there. So just a few patterns that I'll identify and talk about. California, New York, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin are among states with stronger protections for farm workers. California and New York have had documented vibrant farm worker organizing campaigns that we know about that have resulted in stronger protections in those states. States with no protections in these categories are all southern states with Republican leadership. And obviously you can think about party leadership here. Democrats generally think more favorably of organized labor interests, but also I like to think about, you know, the history that we talked about in the New Deal in the South specifically, and I'd love to see, you know, how these legislative histories of these states have led to generally a total lack of movement on labor protections, not just for farm workers. Some obvious barriers to change here. Despite demographic shifts in the population of farm workers, there are some important trends we have to pay attention to. Farm work has generally been performed by disenfranchised, marginalized populations with few other options. When agricultural exceptionalism was first codified, farm workers were mostly black sharecroppers, as we discussed. Various groups of immigrants since have rotated through farm work, usually until they gain improved social status or rights and are replaced by the next more vulnerable group of workers, and if you're interested in this ethnic succession of farm workers, I highly recommend two books. One is Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies by Seth Holmes, and one is Labor in the Locavore by Margaret Gray. They do a great job of talking us through the history of ethnic succession in this country of farm workers and why that is. Farm workers face several barriers to improving their conditions. Immigration status is obviously a huge one. There's an understandable fear of organizing and drawing attention to oneself when one is undocumented. The more recent you are as an immigrant in this country, as a farm worker, it's shown that you're less likely to organize. Not to mention they generally lack collective bargaining rights. This is another major area of exceptionalism in this country. This means farm workers, in most cases, they don't have protections when they join a union. They don't have protections against their employer for punishing them when they join a union. To my knowledge, in California, California is the only state that explicitly provides farm workers with collective bargaining rights. That doesn't mean that there's not organizing in other states, but there's less protection. And obviously the power of agricultural interest groups is huge. We saw that in the New Deal, and that continues to today. There's plenty of evidence that ag interests influence both federal and state legislation, and this includes the organic industry. There's good evidence out there that the organic industry has also fought increased labor protections for farm workers, and I can give people references on that if you're interested. And finally, it's worth mentioning that legislation and regulation are not enforcement. Wage theft is rampant among farm workers, which means that even these lesser protections that they're offered are often violated without recourse. And I'll just end on a more positive note. Despite these odds, there have been notable victories for agricultural workers. Gains made by the United Farm Workers and other unions have won increased labor protections and better grower contracts through collective bargaining. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers has worked to ensure better pay for farm workers in the supply chain of several major food corporations, and I wish Jose Oliva was here to tell us more about that. But and then finally, the alternative food movement is paying increased attention to labor issues. I am an example of that. Cross-movement alliances between labor and food movements are growing and should continue to grow. In my opinion, labor standards have to become a crucial component of any movement towards food justice and food sovereignty. I've worked on the food system for a long time, and I think it's wonderful that we pay attention to animal welfare and we pay attention to the environment and all of these wonderful things, but we have to pay attention to the human beings in the food system. And also in terms of just food access, again, it's wonderful. We think about access and are there supermarkets where people are living and all of that, but I think in public health we really cannot ignore the economic root causes here in terms of payment and employment. That's my little soapbox, and I'll leave you with that. I'm excited to hear what the other folks have to say and have a good conversation with you all.